This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Exodus by Leon Uris. Read for you by Paul Michael. Book 1. Beyond Jordan. Until the Lord have given rest unto your brethren, as well as unto you, and until they also possess the land which the Lord your God hath given them beyond Jordan, and then shall ye return every man unto his possession, which I have given you. The word of God as given to Moses in Deuteronomy. Chapter 1. November 1946. Welcome to Cyprus. William Shakespeare. The airplane plip-plopped down the runway to a halt before the big sign, Welcome to Cyprus. Mark Parker looked out of the window, and in the distance he could see the jagged wonder of the peak of Five Fingers of the northern coastal range. In an hour or so, he would be driving through the pass to Kyrenia. He stepped into the aisle, straightened out his necktie, rolled down his sleeves, and slipped into his jacket. Welcome to Cyprus. Welcome to Cyprus. It ran through his head. It was from Othello, he thought. But the full quotation slipped his mind.
Anything to declare? The customs inspector said. 2 pounds of uncut heroin and a manual of pornographic art, Mark answered, looking about for Kitty.
All Americans are comedians, the inspector thought, as he passed Parker through. A government tourist hostess approached him.
Are you Mr. Mark Parker?
Guilty.
Mrs. Kitty Fremont phoned to say she is unable to meet you at the airport and for you to come straight to Kyrenia to the Dome Hotel. She has a room there for you.
Thanks, Angel. Where can I get a taxi to Kyrenia?
I'll arrange a car for you, sir. It will take a few moments.
Can I get a transfusion around here?
Yes, sir. The coffee counter is straight down the hall.
Mark leaned against the counter and sipped a steaming cup of black coffee.
Welcome to Cyprus. Welcome to Cyprus. He couldn't for the life of him remember.
Say, a voice boomed out. I thought I recognized you on the plane. You're Mark Parker. I bet you don't remember me.
Fill in one of the following, Mark thought. It was Rome, Paris, London, Madrid, and match carefully. Jose's Bar, James's Pub, Jacques' Hideaway, Joe's Joint. At the time, I was covering war, revolution, insurrection. That particular night, I had a blonde, brunette, redhead, or maybe that broad with two heads. The man stood nose to nose with Mark, gushing on all eight cylinders now.
I was the guy who ordered a martini and they didn't have orange bitters. Now do you remember me?
Mark sighed, sipped some coffee, and braced for another onslaught.
I know you hear this all the time, but I really enjoy reading your columns. Say, what are you doing in Cyprus?
The man then winked and jabbed Mark in the ribs.
Something hush-hush, I bet. Why don't we get together for a drink? I'm staying at the Palace in Nicosia.
A business card was slapped into Mark's hand.
Got a few connections here, too.
The man winked again.
Oh, Mr. Parker, your car is ready.
Mark put the cup down on the counter. Nice seeing you again, he said, and walked out quickly. As he departed, he dropped the business card into a trash basket. The taxi headed out from the airport. Mark rested back and closed his eyes for a moment. He was glad that Kitty couldn't get to the airport to meet him. So much time had passed, and there was so much to say and so much to remember. He felt a surge of excitement pass through him at the thought of seeing her again. Kitty. Beautiful, beautiful Kitty. As the taxi passed through the outer gates, Mark was already lost in thought. Catherine Fremont. She was one of those great American traditions like Mom's apple pie, hot dogs, and the Brooklyn Dodgers. For Kitty Fremont was the proverbial girl next door. She was the cliché of pigtails, freckles, tomboys, and braces on the teeth. And true to the cliché, the braces came off one day, the lipstick went on, and the sweater popped out. and the ugly duckling had turned into a graceful swan. Mark smiled to himself. She was so beautiful in those days, so fresh and clean. And Tom Fremont. He was another American tradition. Tom was the crew-cut kid with the boyish grin who could run the 100 in 10 flat, sink a basket from 30 feet out, cut a rug, and put a Model A together blindfolded. Tom Fremont had been Mark's best pal as long as he could remember, for as far back as he could remember. We must have been weaned together, Mark thought. Tom and Kitty. Apple pie and ice cream, hot dogs and mustard. The all-American boy, the all-American girl, and the all-American Midwest of Indiana. Yes, Tom and Kitty fitted together like the rain and springtime. Kitty had always been a quiet girl, very deep, very thoughtful. There was a tinge of sadness in her eyes. Perhaps it was only Mark who detected that sadness, for she was joy itself to everyone around her. Kitty had been one of those wonderful towers of strength. She always had both hands on the rudder, always had the right words to say, always decent and thoughtful. But that sadness was there. Mark knew it if no one else did. Mark often wondered what made her so desirable. Maybe it was because she seemed so unreachable to him. The iced champagne, the look and the word that could tear a man to pieces. Anyhow, Kitty had always been Tom's girl, and the most he could do was envy Tom. Tom and Mark were roommates at State University. That first year, Tom was absolutely miserable being away from Kitty. Mark remembered the hours on end he would have to listen to Tom's mournful laments and console him. Summer came. Kitty went off to Wisconsin with her parents. She was still a high school girl, and her folks wanted to dampen the fervor of the affair with a separation. Tom and Mark hitchhiked to Oklahoma to work in the oil fields. By the time school started again, Tom had cooled down considerably. To remain in Mark's company, one had to sample the field. The times between Tom and Kitty's letters lengthened, and the times between Tom's dates on the campus shortened. It began to look like a strikeout for the college hero and the girl back home. By their senior year, Tom had all but forgotten Kitty. He had become the Beau Brummel of State, a role befitting the ace forward on the basketball team. As for Mark, he was content to bask in Tom's glory and generally make a name for himself as one of the worst journalism students in the university's history. Kitty came to State as a freshman. Lightning struck. Mark could see Kitty a thousand times, and it was always as exciting as the first. This time Tom saw her the same way. They eloped a month before Tom's graduation. Tom and Kitty, Mark and Ellen, a Model A Ford, and $4.10 crossed the state line and sought out a justice of the peace. Their honeymoon was in the back seat of the Model A, bogged down in the mud of a back road and leaking like a sieve in a downpour. It was an auspicious beginning for the all-American couple. Tom and Kitty kept their marriage a secret until a full year after his graduation. Kitty stayed on at State to finish her pre-nursing training. Nursing and Kitty seemed to go together, too, Mark always thought. Tom worshipped Kitty. He had always been a bit wild and too independent, but he settled down to very much the devoted husband. He started out as a very little executive in a very big public relations firm. They moved to Chicago. Kitty nursed in Children's Hospital. They inched their way up, typical American style. First an apartment and then a small home. A new car, monthly bills, big hopes. Kitty became pregnant with Sandra. Mark's thoughts snapped as the taxi slowed through the outskirts of Nicosia, the capital city that sat on the flat brown plain between the northern and southern mountain ranges. "Driver, speak English?" Mark asked. "Yes, sir." "They've got a sign at the airport. Welcome to Cyprus." "What is the full quotation?"
"As far as I know," the driver answered,
They're just trying to be polite to tourists. They entered Nicosia proper. The flatness, the yellow stone houses with their red-tiled roofs, the sea of date palms, all reminded Mark of Damascus. The road ran alongside the ancient Venetian wall, which was built in a perfect circle and surrounded the old city. Mark could see the twin minarets that spiraled over the skyline from the Turkish section of the old city. The minarets that belonged to St. Sophia's, that magnificent Crusader cathedral, turned into a Muslim mosque. As they drove along the wall, they passed the enormous ramparts shaped like arrowheads. Mark remembered from his last visit to Cyprus that there was the odd number of 11 of these arrowheads jutting from the wall. He was about to ask the driver why 11, but decided not to. In a matter of moments, they were out of Nicosia and moving north on the plain. They passed one village after another, monotonously similar, made of gray mud-brick cottages. Each village had one water fountain, which bore an inscription that it was built through the generosity of His Majesty the King of England. In the colorless fields, the peasants labored with the potato crop, working behind those magnificent beasts, the Cyprus mules. The taxi picked up speed again, and Mark sank back to his reveries. Mark and Ellen had gotten married a little after Tom and Kitty. It was a mistake from the first day. Two nice people, not made for each other. Kitty Fremont's quiet and gentle wisdom held Mark and Ellen together. They both could come to her and pour their hearts out. Kitty kept the marriage intact long after time had run out. Then it broke wide open, and they were divorced. Mark was thankful there had been no children. After the divorce, Mark moved east and began banging around from job to job, having matriculated from the world's worst journalism student to the world's worst newspaper man. He became one of those drifters who inhabit the newspaper world. It was not stupidity, nor lack of talent, but complete inability to find his niche in life. Mark was a creative man, and the business of routine reporting cut that creativity. Yet he had no desire to attempt the life of a creative writer. He knew that his personality would not take the demands on a novelist. So Mark hung in limbo, being neither fish nor fowl. Each week there was a letter from Tom, and it would be filled with enthusiasm and the vigor of his climb to the top. The letters were also filled with Tom's love for Kitty and their baby girl, Sandra. Mark remembered Kitty's letters, a calm appraisal of Tom's effervescence. Kitty always kept Mark posted on Ellen's whereabouts until Ellen remarried. In 1938, the world opened up for Mark Parker. There was a post to be filled in Berlin with American News Syndicate, and Mark was suddenly transformed from a newspaper bum into the respectability of a foreign correspondent. In this capacity, Mark proved to be a talented journeyman. He was able to fill part of his desire for creativity by developing a style that labeled him as an individual, as Mark Parker and no one else. Mark was by no means a world beater, but he did have that one great instinct of a crack foreign correspondent, an ability to smell out a story in the making. The world was a lark. He covered Europe, Asia, and Africa from one end to the other. He had a title. He was doing work he liked. His credit was good at Jose's Bar, James's Pub, Joe's and Jacques' Hideaway, and he had an inexhaustible list of candidates for his Blonde, Brunette, or Redhead of the Month club. When the war broke out, Mark chased all over Europe. It was good to settle back in London for a few days, where a stack of mail from Tom and Kitty would be waiting. Early in 1942, Tom Fremont enlisted in the Marine Corps. He was killed at Guadalcanal. 2 months after Tom's death, their baby Sandra died of polio. Mark took emergency leave to return home, but by the time he arrived, Kitty Fremont had disappeared. He searched for her without success until he had to return to Europe. To all intents, she had disappeared from the face of the earth. It was strange to Mark, but that sadness that he always saw in Kitty's eyes seemed like a fulfilled prophecy. The moment the war was over, he returned to look for her again, but the trail had grown cold. In November of 1945, American News Syndicate recalled him to Europe to cover the war crimes trials in Nuremberg. By now, Mark was an established craftsman and bore the title Distinguished Foreign Correspondent. He stayed on, turning in a brilliant series, until the top Nazis were hanged only a few months back. ANS granted Mark a much-needed leave of absence before transferring him to Palestine, where it appeared local war was brewing. To spend his leave in the accepted Mark Parker fashion, he chased down a passionate French UN girl he had met earlier, who had been transferred to the United Nations Relief in Athens. It all happened from a clear blue sky. He was sitting in the American bar, passing the time of day with a group of fellow newsmen, when the conversation somehow drifted to a particular American nurse in Salonika, doing fabulous work with Greek orphans. One of the correspondents had just returned from there with a story on her orphanage. The nurse was Kitty Fremont. Mark inquired immediately and discovered that she was on vacation in Cyprus. The taxi began to move upwards out of the plain on a twisting little road that led through the pass in the Pentadactylus Mountains. It was turning dusk. They reached the peak, and Mark ordered the car to pull over to the side. He stepped out and looked down at the magnificent, jewel-like little town of Kyrenia, nestled against the sea at the foot of the mountain. To the left and above him stood the ruins of St. Hilarion Castle, haunted with the memory of Richard the Lionhearted and his beautiful Berengaria. He made a mental note to come back again with Kitty. It was nearing dark as they reached Kyrenia. The little town was all white plaster and red-tiled roofs, with the castle above it and the sea beside it. Kyrenia was picturesque and remote and quaint, to a point where it could not have been more picturesque or remote or quaint. They passed the miniature harbor, filled with fishing smacks and small yachts, set inside two arms of a seawall. On one arm was the quay. On the other arm stood an ancient fortress rampart, the Virgin Castle. Kyrenia had long been a retreat for artists and retired British Army officers. It was, indeed, one of the most peaceful places on earth. A block away from the harbor stood the Dome Hotel. Physically, the big building seemed outsized and out of place for the rest of the sleepy little town. The dome, however, had become a crossroads of the British Empire. It was known in every corner of the world that flew a Union Jack as a place where Englishmen met. It was a maze of public rooms and terraces and verandas sitting over the sea. A long pier of 100 yards or more connected the hotel to a tiny island offshore used by swimmers and sunbathers. The taxi pulled to a stop. The bellboy gathered in Mark's luggage. Mark paid off his driver and looked about. It was November, but it was warmish yet, and it was serene. What a wonderful place for a reunion with Kitty Fremont. The desk clerk handed Mark a message. "Mark, darling, I am stuck in Famagusta until 9 o'clock. Will you ever forgive me? Dying with anxiety. Love, Kitty. I want some flowers, a bottle of scotch, and a bucket of ice," Mark said. "Mrs. Fremont has taken care of everything," the room clerk said, handing a key to the bellboy. "You have adjoining rooms overlooking the sea." Mark detected a smirk on the clerk's face. It was the same kind of dirty look he had seen in 100 hotels with 100 women. He was about to set the record straight, but decided to let the clerk think anything he damned well pleased. He gathered in the view of the sea as it turned dark. Then he unpacked and mixed himself a scotch and water and drank it while he soaked in a steaming tub. 7 o'clock. Still 2 hours to wait. He opened the door of Kitty's room. It smelled good. Her bathing suit and some freshly washed hosiery hung over the bathtub. Her shoes were lined up beside the bed and her makeup on the vanity. Mark smiled. Even with Kitty gone, the empty room was full of the character of an unusual person. He went back and stretched out on his bed. What had the years done to her? What had the tragedy done? Kitty, beautiful Kitty, please be all right. It was now November of 1946, Mark figured. When was the last time he saw her? 1938? Just before he went to Berlin for ANS? 8 years ago. Kitty would be 28 years old now. The excitement and tension caught up with Mark. He was tired, and he began to doze. The tinkle of ice cubes, a sweet sound to Mark Parker, brought him out of a deep sleep. He rubbed his eyes and groped around for a cigarette.
"You sleep as though you were drugged," a very British accent said. "I knocked for 5 minutes. The bellboy let me in. Hope you don't mind me helping myself to the whiskey."
The voice belonged to Major Fred Caldwell of the British Army. Mark yawned, stretched himself into wakefulness, and checked his watch. It was 8:15. "What the hell are you doing on Cyprus?" Mark asked.
"I believe that is my question."
Mark lit a cigarette and looked at Caldwell. He didn't like the major, nor did he hate him. Despise was the suitable word. They had met before, twice. Caldwell had been the aide of Colonel, later Brigadier, Bruce Sutherland, quite a good field officer in the British Army. Their first meeting had been in the lowlands near Holland during the war. In one of his reports, Mark had pointed out a British tactical blunder that had caused a regiment of men to get cut to pieces. The second meeting had been at the Nuremberg war crimes trials, which Mark was covering for ANS. Toward the end of the war, Bruce Sutherland's troops were the first to enter the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in Germany. Both Sutherland and Caldwell had come to Nuremberg to give testimony. Mark walked to the bathroom, washed his face with icy water, and fished around for a towel.
"What can I do for you, Freddy?" "CID phoned over to our headquarters this afternoon and told us you landed. You haven't been issued credentials."
"Christ, you're a suspicious bunch of bastards."
"Sorry to disappoint you, Freddy. I'm here on vacation en route to Palestine."
"This isn't an official call, Parker," Caldwell said. "Just say we're a bit touchy over past relationships."
"You have long memories," Mark said, and began dressing. Caldwell mixed Mark a drink. Mark studied the British officer and wondered why Caldwell always managed to rub him the wrong way. There was that arrogance about him that stamped him as a member of that quaint breed, the colonizer. Caldwell was a stuffy and narrow-minded bore, a gentleman's game of tennis in whites, a bashing gin and tonic, and damn the natives. It was Freddy Caldwell's conscience, or the utter lack of it, that bothered Mark. The meaning of right and wrong came to Caldwell through an army manual or an order.
"You boys covering up some dirty work on Cyprus?"
"Don't be a bore, Parker. We own this island, and we want to know what you want here."
"You know, that's what I like about you British. A Dutchman would tell me to get the hell out. You fellas always say, please go to hell."
"I said I was on vacation, a reunion with an old friend."
"Who?"
"A girl named Kitty Fremont."
"Kitty, the nurse? Yes. Smashing woman, smashing. We met at the governor's a few days back."
Freddy Caldwell's eyebrows raised questioningly as he looked at the connecting door to Kitty's room, which stood ajar.
"Go give your filthy mind a bath," Mark said. "I've known her for 25 years.
"Then, as you Americans say, everything's on the up and up."
"That's right. And from this point on, your visit becomes social. So get out."
Freddy Caldwell smiled and set down his glass and tucked the swagger stick under his arm.
"Freddy Caldwell," Mark said, "I want to see you when that smile is wiped off your face."
"What the devil are you talking about?"
"This is 1946, Major. A lot of people read the campaign slogans in the last war and believed them. You're a dollar short and an hour late. You're going to lose the whole shooting match. First, it's going to be India.
then Africa, then the Middle East. I'll be there to watch you lose the Palestine mandate. They're going to boot you out of even Suez and Transjordan. The sun is setting on the empire, Freddy. What is your wife going to do without 40 little black boys to whip?
I read your coverage of the Nuremberg trials, Parker. You have that terrible American tendency toward being overdramatic. Corny is the word, I think. Besides, old boy, I don't have a wife.
You boys are polite.
Remember, Parker, you are on vacation. I'll give Brigadier Sutherland your regards. Cheerio!
Mark smiled and shrugged. Then it came back to him. The sign at the airport. Welcome to Cyprus, William Shakespeare. The full quote was, Welcome to Cyprus, goats and monkeys. Chapter 2. During the hours in which Mark Parker awaited his long-delayed reunion with Kitty Fremont, two other men awaited a reunion of a far different sort in a different part of Cyprus. 40 miles away from Kyrenia, north of the port city of Famagusta, they waited in a forest. It was cloudy, socked in, with no light from the sky. The two men stood in utter silence and squinted through the dark toward the bay a half-mile down the hill. They were in an abandoned white house on the hill in the midst of a forest of pines and eucalyptus and acacias. It was still and black, except for a wisp of wind and the muffled, unsteady breathing of the two men. One of the men was a Greek Cypriot, a Forest Service ranger, and he was nervous. The other man appeared as calm as a statue, never moving his eyes from the direction of the water. His name was David Ben-Ami. His name meant David, son of my people. The clouds began to break. Light fell over the still waters of the bay and on the forest and the white house. David Ben-Ami stood in the window, and the light played on his face. He was a man of slight build in his early 20s. Even in the poor light, his thin face and his deep eyes showed the sensitivity of a scholar. As the clouds swept away, the light crept over fields of broken marble columns and statuary that littered the ground about the White House. Broken stone, the mortal remains of the once great city of Salamis, which stood mighty in the time of Christ. What history lay beneath this ground and throughout the fields of marble? Salamis, founded in times barely recorded by men, by the warrior Teucer, on his return from the Trojan Wars. It fell by earthquake, and it rose again, and it fell once more to the Arab sword under the banner of Islam, never to arise again. The light danced over the acres and acres of thousands of broken columns where a great Greek forum once stood. The clouds closed, and it was dark again.
He is long overdue, the Greek Cypriot forest ranger whispered nervously. Listen,
David Ben-Ami said. A faint sound of a boat's motor was heard from far out on the water. David Ben-Ami lifted his field glasses, hoping for a break in the clouds. The sound of the motor grew louder. A flash of light streaked out from the water toward the white house on the hill. Another flash. Another. David Ben-Ami and the forest ranger raced from the White House down the hill and through the rubble and the woods till they reached the shoreline. Ben-Ami returned the signal with his own flashlight. The sound of the motor stopped. A shadowy figure of a man slipped over the side of the boat and began to swim toward the shore. David Ben-Ami cocked his Sten gun and looked up and down the beach for signs of a British patrol. The figure emerged from the deep water and waded in.
David,
a voice called from the water.
Ari, he answered back. This way, quickly.
On the beach, the three men ran past the white house and onto a dirt road. A taxi waited, hidden in the brush. Ben-Ami thanked the Cypriot forest ranger, and he and the man from the boat sped off in the direction of Famagusta. My cigarettes are soaked, Ari said. David Ben-Ami passed him a pack.
A brief flame glowed over the face of the man who was called Ari. He was large and husky, in complete contrast to the small Ben Ami. His face was handsome, but there was a set hardness in his eyes. He was Ari Ben Kanan, and he was the crack agent of the Mossad Aliyah Bet, the illegal organization. Chapter 3. There was a knock on Mark Parker's door. He opened it. Catherine Fremont stood before him. She was even more beautiful than he remembered. They stared at each other silently for a long time. He studied her face and her eyes. She was a woman now, soft and compassionate in the way one gets only through terrible suffering. "I ought to break your damned neck for not answering my letters," Mark said.
"Hello, Mark," she whispered.
They fell into each other's arms and clung to each other. Then for the first hour they spoke little but contented themselves with looking at each other with quick smiles, occasional pressing of hands, and affectionate kisses on the cheek. At dinner they made small talk, mostly of Mark's adventures as a foreign correspondent. Then Mark became aware that Kitty was steering all the conversation away from any talk of herself. The final dish of cheeses came. Mark poured the last of his Kyo beer, and another of the many awkward silent periods followed. Now Kitty was obviously growing uncomfortable under his questioning stare. "Come on," he said. "Let's take a walk to the harbor."
"I'll get my stole," she said.
They walked silently along the quay, lined with white buildings, and onto the seawall and out to the lighthouse which stood at the narrow opening of the harbor. It was cloudy, and they could see but dim outlines of the little boats resting at anchor. They watched the lighthouse blink out to sea, guiding a trawler toward the shelter of the harbor. A soft wind blew through Kitty's golden hair. She tightened the stole over her shoulders. Mark lit a cigarette and sat on the wall. It was deathly still. "I've made you very unhappy by coming here," he said. "I'll leave tomorrow."
"I don't want you to go," she said.
She looked away out to the sea.
"I don't know how I felt when I received your cable. It opened the door on a lot of memories that I've tried awfully hard to bury. Yet I knew that one day this minute would come. In a way, I've dreaded it. In a way, I'm glad it's here."
"It's been 4 years since Tom got killed. Aren't you ever going to shake this?"
"Women lose husbands in war," she whispered. "I cried for Tom. We were very much in love, but I knew I would go on living. I don't even know how he died."
"There wasn't much to it," Mark said. "Tom was a Marine, and he went in to take a beach with 10,000 other Marines. A bullet hit him, and he died. No hero, no medals, no time to say, 'Tell Kitty I love her.' Just got hit by a bullet and died. That's it." The blood drained from her face. Mark lit a cigarette and handed it to her.
"Why did Sandra die? Why did my baby have to die too?"
"I'm not God. I can't answer that." She sat beside Mark on the seawall and rested her head on his shoulder and sighed unevenly.
"I guess there is no place left for me to run," she said.
"Why don't you tell me about it?"
"I can't."
"I think it's about time that you did." A half dozen times Kitty tried to speak, but her voice held only short, disconnected whispers. The years of terror were locked deep in her. She threw the cigarette into the water and looked at Mark. He was right. And he was the only one in the world she could confide in.
"It was pretty terrible," she said. "When I got the telegram about Tom, I loved him so. Just 2 months after that, Sandra died of polio. I don't remember too much. My parents took me away to Vermont and put me in a home."
"Asylum?"
No. That's the name they give it for poor people. They called mine a rest home for a breakdown. I don't know how many months passed there. I couldn't remember everything. I was in a complete fog, day and night. Melancholia, they call it.
Suddenly, Kitty's voice became steady. The door had opened, and the torment was finding its way out.
One day the veil over my mind lifted, and I remembered that Tom and Sandra were dead. A pain clung to me. Everything, every minute of the day, reminded me of them. Every time I heard a song, every time I heard laughter, every time I saw a child, every breath I took hurt me. I prayed. I prayed, Mark, that the fog would fall on me again. Yes, I prayed I'd go insane so I couldn't remember.
She stood up tall and straight, and the tears streamed down her cheeks.
I ran away to New York, tried to bury myself in the throngs. I had four walls, a chair, a table, a swinging light bulb.
She let out a short, ironic laugh.
There was even a flickering neon sign outside my window. Corny, wasn't it? I'd walk aimlessly for hours on the streets till all the faces were a blur, or I'd sit and look out of the window for days at a time. Tom, Sandra, Tom, Sandra. It never left me for a moment.
Kitty felt Mark behind her. His hands gripped her shoulders. Out in the water, the trawler was nearing the opening between the arms of the seawall. She brushed her cheek against Mark's hand.
One night I drank too much. You know me, I'm a terrible drinker. I saw a boy in a green uniform like Tom's. He was lonely and crew-cut and tall, like Tom. We drank together. I woke up in a cheap, dirty hotel room, God knows where. I was still half drunk. I staggered to the mirror and I looked at myself. I was naked. The boy was naked, too, sprawled out on the bed.
Kitty, for God's sake.
It's all right, Mark. Let me finish. I stood there, looking in that mirror. I don't know how long. I had reached the bottom of my life. There was no place lower for me. That moment, that second, I was done. The boy was unconscious. Strange. I don't even remember his name. I saw his razor blades in the bathroom and the gas pipe from the ceiling. And for a minute or an hour, I don't know how long, I stood looking down 10 stories over the sidewalk. The end of my life had come, but I did not have the strength to take it. Then a strange thing happened, Mark. I knew that I was going to go on living without Tom and Sandra. And suddenly the pain was gone.
Kitty, darling, I wanted so much to find you and help you.
I know. But it was something I had to fight out myself, I suppose. I went back to nursing, plunged into it like crazy. The minute it was over in Europe, I took on this Greek orphanage. It was a 24-hour-a-day job. That's what I needed, of course, to work myself to the limit. Mark, I've started 100 letters to you. Somehow I've been too terrified of this minute. I'm glad now. I'm glad it's over.
I'm glad I found you, Mark said. She spun around and faced him.
So, that is the story of what has become of Kitty Fremont.
Mark took her hand and they began walking back along the seawall to the quay. From the Dome Hotel, they could hear the sound of music. Chapter 4 Brigadier Bruce Sutherland sat behind a big desk as military commander of Cyprus in his house on Hippocrates Street in Famagusta, some 40 miles from Kyrenia. Except for small telltale traces, a slight roll around his middle and a whitening of the hair about his temples, Sutherland's appearance belied his 55 years. His ramrod posture clearly identified a military man. A sharp knock sounded on the door, and his aide, Major Fred Caldwell, entered.
"Good evening, Caldwell. Back from Kyrenia already? Have a chair."
Sutherland shoved the papers aside, stretched, and put his glasses on the desk. He selected a GBD pipe from the rack and dipped it into a humidor of Dunhill mix. Caldwell thanked the brigadier for a cigar, and the two men soon clouded the room in smoke. The Greek houseboy appeared in answer to a buzz.
"Gin and tonic, twice."
Sutherland arose and walked into the full light. He was wearing a deep red velvet smoking jacket. He settled into a leather chair before the high shelves of books.
"Did you see Mark Parker?"
"Yes, sir."
"What do you think?"
Caldwell shrugged.
"On the face of it, we certainly can't accuse him of anything. He is on the way to Palestine, here to see that American nurse, Catherine Fremont."
"Fremont? Oh, yes, that lovely woman we met at the governor's."
"So I say, sir, it all appears quite innocent. Yet Parker is a reporter, and I can't forget that trouble he caused us in Holland."
"Oh, come now," Sutherland retorted. "We all made blunders in the war. He just happened to catch one of ours. Fortunately, our side won. And I don't think there are 10 people who remember."
The gin and tonics arrived.
"Cheers."
Sutherland set his glass down and patted his white walrus mustache. Fred Caldwell wasn't satisfied.
"Sir," he persisted, "in case Parker does become curious and does decide to snoop around, don't you think it would be wise to have a couple of CID men watching him?"
"See here. You leave him alone. Just tell a newspaper man no, and you're apt to stir up a hornet's nest. Refugee stories are out of style these days, and I don't believe he would be interested in their camps here. Nonetheless, we are not going to run the risk of arousing his curiosity by forbidding him to do anything. If you ask me, I think it was a mistake for you to see him today."
"But, Brigadier, after that trouble in Holland..."
"Bring the chess table, Freddy."
There was something absolutely final about the way Sutherland said, "Freddy." Caldwell grumbled under his breath as they set up the chessmen. They made their opening moves, but Sutherland could see that his aide was unhappy. He set down his pipe and leaned back.
"Caldwell, I have tried to explain to you that we are not running concentration camps here. The refugees at Karolos are merely being detained on Cyprus until those blockheads in Whitehall decide what they are going to do with the Palestine Mandate."
"But those Jews are so unruly," Caldwell said. "I'm certainly in favor of some good old-fashioned discipline."
"No, Freddy, not this time. These people are not criminals, and they've got world sympathy on their side. It is your job and mine to see that there are no riots, no outbreaks, and nothing that can be used as propaganda against us. Do you understand that?"
Caldwell didn't understand. He damned well thought that the brigadier should be much tougher with the refugees. But no one wins an argument with a general unless he happens to be a bigger general. And it was all so deep. So Caldwell moved a pawn forward.
"Your move, sir," he said.
Caldwell looked up from the board. Sutherland seemed completely withdrawn and oblivious of him. It was happening more and more lately.
"Your move, sir," Caldwell repeated.
Sutherland's face was troubled.
Poor chap, Caldwell thought.
The brigadier had been married to Nettie Sutherland for almost 30 years, and suddenly she had left him and run off to Paris with a lover 10 years her junior. It was a scandal that rocked army circles for months, and Sutherland must still be taking it hard. Terrible blow for the brigadier. He had always been such a decent sort of chap. The white face of Sutherland was lined with wrinkles, and little red veins on his nose turned bright. At this moment, he looked all of his 55 years and more. Bruce Sutherland was not thinking about Nettie, as Caldwell believed. His mind was on the refugee camps at Karolos.
"Your move, sir."
"So shall your enemies perish, Israel."
Sutherland mumbled.
What did you say, sir?
Chapter 5. Mark led Kitty back to the table, both of them breathless.
Do you know the last time I danced a samba?
She said. You're not so bad for an old broad. Mark looked around the room filled with British officers in their army khakis and navy whites and their high and low English accents. Mark loved places like this. The waiter brought a new round of drinks, and they clicked glasses. To Kitty. Wherever she may be, Mark said. Well, ma'am, where do you go from here? Kitty shrugged.
Golly, I don't know, Mark. My work is finished at Salonika, and I am getting restless. I've got a dozen offers I can take around Europe with the United Nations.
It was a lovely war, Mark said. Lots of orphans.
Matter of fact, Kitty said, I got a real good offer to stay right here on Cyprus just yesterday.
On Cyprus?
They have some refugee camps around Famagusta. Anyhow, some American woman contacted me. Seems that the camps are overcrowded and they're opening new ones on the Larnaca Road. She wanted me to take charge.
Mark frowned.
That's one of the reasons I couldn't meet you at the airport. I went to Famagusta to see her today.
And what did you tell her?
I told her no. They were Jews. I suppose Jewish children are pretty much like any others, but I'd just rather not get mixed up with them. It seems that there's an awful lot of politics connected with those camps, and they're not under UN auspices.
Mark was silent in thought. Kitty winked mischievously and waggled a finger under his nose.
Don't be so serious. You want to know the other reason I didn't meet you at the airport?
You're acting tipsy.
I'm starting to feel that way. Well, Mr. Parker, I was in Famagusta seeing my boyfriend off. You know me. One lover leaves by ship while another lands by airplane.
As long as you brought it up, who was this guy you came to Cyprus with?
Wouldn't you like to know?
Uh-huh.
Colonel Howard Hillings of the British Army.
Anything dirty between you two?
Damn it, no. He was so proper, it was disgusting.
Where did you meet this guy?
Salonika. He was in charge of the British mission in the area. When I took over the orphanage, we were short of everything. Beds, medicine, food, blankets, everything. Anyhow, I went to him, and he cut wads of red tape for me, and we became friends forever and ever and ever. He really is a dear man.
Go on. It's getting interesting.
He got notice a few weeks ago that he was being transferred to Palestine, and he had leave coming and wanted me to spend it with him here. You know, I'd been working so hard I'd completely forgotten I haven't had a day off in 18 months. Anyhow, they cut his leave short, and he had to report to Famagusta to sail to Palestine today.
Future prospects as Mrs. Hillings?
Kitty shook her head. I like him very much. He brought me all the way to Cyprus to find the right setting to ask me to marry him.
And?
I loved Tom. I'll never feel that way again.
You're 28 years old, Kitty. It's a good age to retire.
I'm not complaining. I've found something that keeps me content. Mark, you're going to Palestine, too. There are a lot of officers here leaving for Palestine.
There's going to be a war, Kitty.
Why? I don't understand.
Oh, lots of reasons. A lot of people around the world have decided they want to run their own lives. Colonies are going out of vogue this century. These boys here are riding a dead horse. This is the soldier of the new empire, Mark said, taking a dollar bill from his pocket. We've got millions of these green soldiers moving into every corner of the world. Greatest occupying force you've ever seen. A bloodless conquest. But Palestine? That's different again. Kitty, there's almost something frightening about it. Some people are out to resurrect a nation that has been dead for 2,000 years. Nothing like that has ever happened before. What's more, I think they're going to do it. It's these same Jews you don't like.
I didn't say I didn't like Jews, Kitty insisted.
I won't debate with you now. Think real hard, honey. Since you've been on Cyprus, Have you heard anything or seen anything that might be, well, unusual?
Kitty bit her lip in thought and sighed.
Only the refugee camps. I hear they are overcrowded and in deplorable condition. Why do you ask?
I don't know. Just say I've got an intuition that something very big is happening on Cyprus.
Why don't you just say you're naturally nosy by profession?
It's more than that. Do you know a Major Fred Caldwell? He's aide to Brigadier Sutherland.
Terrible bore. I met him at the governor's.
He met me in my room before you got in. Why would a general's aide be sitting on my lap 10 minutes after I landed on a matter that is seemingly trivial?
Kitty, I tell you, the British are nervous about something here.
I can't put my finger on it, but 5 will get you 10. It's tied up with those refugee camps. Look, would you go to work in those camps for me for a few weeks?
Certainly, Mark, if you want me to.
Ah, the hell with it, Mark said, setting down his drink. Us 2 kids are on vacation. You're right. I'm nosy and suspicious by profession. Forget it. Let's dance.
Chapter 6. On Arsinos Street in Famagusta, facing the wall of the old city, sat a large and luxurious house belonging to a Greek Cypriot named Mandria, who was owner of the Cyprus Mediterranean Shipping Company, as well as owner of a great number of the island's taxicabs. Mandria and David Ben-Ami waited anxiously as Ari Ben-Kanan cleaned up and changed into dry clothing after his swim ashore. They both knew that the appearance of Ari Ben-Kanan on Cyprus meant a top-level mission for Mossad Aliyah Bet. British policy for many years had been to exclude or extremely limit the Jewish immigration to Palestine. They had the Royal Navy to execute this policy. The Mossad Aliyah Bet was an organization of Palestinian Jews whose business it was to help smuggle other Jews into Palestine. However, as fast as the British Navy caught the Mossad boats trying to run the blockade, the refugees would be transferred to detention camps on Cyprus. Ari Ben-Kanan, in a fresh change of clothing, entered the room and nodded to Mandria and David Ben-Ami. The Palestinian was a big man, well over 6 feet and well-built. He and Ben-Ami had long been intimate friends, but they played a role of formality in front of Mandria, the Cypriot, who was not a member of their organization, but merely a sympathizer. Ari lit a cigarette and got right to the point. Headquarters has sent me here to stage a mass escape from the detention camps. The reasons are obvious to all of us. What is your opinion, David? The thin young man from Jerusalem paced the room thoughtfully. He had been sent to Cyprus months before by the secret army of the Jews in Palestine called the Palmach. He and dozens of other Palmachniks smuggled themselves into the compounds of refugees without the knowledge of the British and set up schools, hospitals, and synagogues, built sanitation facilities, and organized light industry. The refugees who had been turned back from Palestine to Cyprus were hopeless people. The appearance of young Palestinians of the Jews' army infused new hope and morale. David Ben-Ami and the other Palmachniks gave military training to several thousand men and women among the refugees, using sticks as rifles and rocks as grenades. Although he was but 22 years of age, David was the Palmach commander in Cyprus. If the British had gotten wind that there were Palestinians inside the camps, they kept quiet about it, for they did their guarding from the outside, having no desire to go into the hate-riddled compounds.
"How many people do you want to escape?"
David asked.
300, more or less.
David shook his head.
We have a few tunnels dug, but those lead to the sea.
As you know, by coming in here tonight, the tides are treacherous and only strong swimmers can make it. Second, we move in and out through the garbage dumps. They are loosely guarded, but we could never get that many people through. Third, British uniforms and false papers. Again, we can only get a few in and out at a time. Last, we crate some of our members up in boxes and send them to the docks. Mr. Mandria here owns the shipping company, and his dock hands are on the alert for these crates. At this moment, Ari, I see no way to pull a mass escape.
We will find a way, Ben Canaan said matter-of-factly. But we only have a few weeks to complete this job. Mandria, the Greek, arose, sighed, and shook his head.
Mr. Ben Canaan, you have swum ashore tonight and asked us to do the impossible.
In 2 weeks yet. In my heart, Mandria said, touching his heart, I say that it will be done. But in my head, and Mandria tapped his skull with his forefinger, it cannot be done.
The Cypriot clasped his hands behind him and paced the dining room.
Believe me, Mr. Ben Canaan.
He swung around and made a bravado sweep of the arm.
You Palmach and Mossad people can count on the Greeks of Cyprus to back you to the last drop of blood. We are for you. We are with you. We are behind you.
Nevertheless, Cyprus is an island, and it is surrounded by water on all sides, and the British are not stupid or asleep.
I, Mandria, will do everything for you. But still, you are not getting 300 people out of Carlos. There are 10-foot walls of barbed wire around those compounds, and the guards carry rifles with bullets in them.
Ari Ben Canaan arose and towered over the other two men. He had ignored much of Mandria's dramatics.
I will need a British uniform, papers, and a driver by morning.
You can start looking for a boat, Mr. Mandria. Something between 100 and 200 tons.
David, we will need an expert forger.
We have a boy out in the children's compound who is supposed to be a real artist, but he won't work. The rest of the stuff is primitive.
I'll go out to Carlos tomorrow and talk to him. I want to look over the camp anyhow.
Mandria was elated. What a man of action Ari Ben Canaan was.
Find a ship, find a forger, get me a uniform and a driver.
Life was so exciting since the Mossad and Palmach had come to Cyprus, and he so loved being a part of the cat-and-mouse game with the British. He stood up and pumped Ari Ben Canaan's hand.
We Cypriots are with you. Your battle is our battle.
Ben Canaan looked at Mandria disgustedly.
Mr. Mandria, he said, you are being well paid for your time and efforts.
A stunned silence fell on the room. Mandria turned as white as a sheet.
Do you believe? Do you dare believe, sir, that I, Mandria, would do this for money? Do you think I risk 10 years in prison and exile from my home? It has cost me over £5,000 since I began working with your Palmach.
David stepped in quickly. I think you had better apologize to Mr. Mandria. He and his taxi drivers and his dockhands take all sorts of risks. Without the help of the Greek people, our work would be nearly impossible.
Mandria slumped into a chair, deeply wounded. Yes, Mr. Ben Canaan, we admire you. We feel that if you can throw the British out of Palestine, then maybe we can do the same on Cyprus someday.
My apologies, Mr. Mandria, Ari said. I must be over tense.
He recited the words completely without meaning. A shrill sound of sirens outside brought the conversation to a stop. Mandria opened the French doors to the balcony and walked outside with David. Ari Ben Canaan stood behind them. They saw an armored car with machine guns leading a convoy of lorries up the street from the docks. There were 25 lorries in all, surrounded by machine guns mounted on jeeps. The lorries were packed with refugees from the illegal ship Door of Hope, which had tried to run the British blockade from Italy to Palestine. The Door of Hope had been rammed by a British destroyer, towed to Haifa, and the refugees transferred immediately to Cyprus. The sirens shrieked louder as the convoy swept close to the balcony of Mandria's home. The lorries passed one by one. The three men could see the jam of tattered, ragged misery. They were beaten people at the end of the line, dazed, withered, exhausted. The sirens shrieked, and the convoy turned at the land gate of the old wall and onto the road to Salamis, in the direction of the British detention camps at Karaolis. The convoy faded from sight, but the shrieks of the sirens lingered on and on. David Ben-Ami's hands were tight fists, and his teeth were clenched in a face livid with helpless rage. Mandria wept openly. Only Ari Ben Canaan showed no emotion. They walked in from the balcony.
I know you two have much to talk over, Mandria said between sobs. I hope you find your room comfortable, Mr. Ben Kanan. We will have your uniform, papers, and a taxi by morning. Good night.
The instant David and Ari were alone, they threw their arms about each other. The big man picked the little man up and set him down as though he were a child. They looked each other over and congratulated each other on looking well and went into another bear hug.
Jordana, David said anxiously, did you see her before you left? Did she give you a message?
Ari scratched his jaw teasingly.
No, let me see.
Please, Ari, it has been months since I have received a letter.
Ari sighed and withdrew an envelope which David snatched from his hands. I put it in a rubber pouch. The only thing I could think of tonight when I was swimming in was that you would break my neck if I got your damned letter wet.
David was not listening. He squinted in the half-light and slowly read the words of a woman who missed and longed for her lover. He folded the letter tenderly and carefully placed it in his breast pocket to be read again and again, for it might be months before she could send another.
How is she?
David asked.
I don't see what my sister sees in you. Jordana? Jordana is Jordana. She's wild and beautiful, and she loves you very much.
My parents? My brothers? How is our Palmach gang? What?
Wait a minute, wait a minute. I'll be here for a while. One question at a time.
David pulled out the letter and read it again, and the two men were silent. They stared out of the French doors at the ancient wall across the road.
How are things at home?
David whispered.
Things at home? The same as always. Bombings, shootings. Exactly as it has been every day since we were children. It never changes. Every year we come to a crisis which is sure to wipe us out. Then we go on to another crisis worse than the last. Home